Down through the centuries, men and women have used various means of expressing their love to one another. I suppose if you're gifted in writing songs, you have, like many others, written a song to one that you love. If you're able to put it to music, all the better, and if you're able to sing it, that's even the best. Singing to someone your love message. Other people have had the money and the time and the means to erect monuments to one that they love, to build buildings in their name, or even cities down in the history of time. But I suppose of all the expressions that men and women have used to describe their love for one another, the most common is the writing of poetic verse. Who hasn't been thrilled in reading just those lines from that sonnet by Browning? How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. Or from Poe. And this maiden she lived with no other thought than to love and be loved by me. She was a child and I was a child in this kingdom by the sea, but we loved with a love that was more than love, I and my Annabel Lee. Oh, I guess I'm a romanticist at heart when it comes to poetry. I appreciated the writings of Roy Croft in days past. He said this, I love you not only for what you are, but for what I am when I am with you. I love you not only for what you have made of yourself, but for what you are making of me. I love you for the part of me you bring out. I love you for putting your hand into my heaped up heart and passing over all the foolish, weak things that you can't help dimly seeing there, and for drawing out into the light all the beautiful belongings that no one else had looked quite far enough to find. I love you because you are helping me to make of the lumber of my life not a tavern, but a temple. Out of the works of my everyday, not a reproach, but a song. And on and on. Poems of love have a couple of things in common. First of all, they are extremely personal, and they are at times even intimate. They're never meant to be shared with someone else other than the lover. And I suppose many of us have had the experience of having a teacher find a note that we wrote to someone else in the class. And humiliation upon humiliation, reading that love note to the class. That is the living end of embarrassment. It's a very personal love note. It's not meant to be shared with anybody else. Some time back, in fact, years ago, I used to write poetry to my wife. And it occurred to me in recent months that I hadn't done that for some time, and I wanted to do that. And I felt a burst of creativity, and I sat down, and I wrote lines that expressed my affection. Just before I took a trip out of the city for several days, I left that note with her. And to my amazement, when I got home, she had taken that little love note and had taped it on the window in front of the kitchen sink. And our teenagers had been reading that love note. And they were not reading it as I had written it. Oh, my dearest darling. Nobody else can read a love note that you wrote to somebody like you meant it. It's meant for that person and that person only. The second thing about a love note is it is meant to be enjoyed, not analyzed. Now, when I say these things, I am introducing to all of us the Song of Solomon. It is a love note. Solomon and his lover, who became his bride, his wife, never dreamed that centuries of people would be reading their love note. I am convinced they had no idea that we would be looking over their shoulders and reading their very intimate remarks to one another. After all, how could we understand fully what they meant? It's a lengthy love note of some 8 chapters in our Bible, and it's really not meant to be analyzed, to say nothing of abused as it has been down through the years. As men and women have attempted to interpret this wonderful book in the most fanciful manner, when in reality it is simply a small vignette of a love relationship between a man and a woman in the days of Solomon. Sure, there is probably an analogy of Christ's love for his church that is latent within this poem, but I don't think when Solomon wrote it and his lover read it, and when she wrote it and he read her words, that was in mind at all. Let's look at it as best we can in the time we have, and let's draw from it some guidelines for our love relationship today. They are here for us to enjoy. First of all, some introductory information that would help. Who wrote it? Well, the first verse assures us that this is Solomon's work. This is the Song of Songs. It is the most exquisite of all of his 1,005 songs. 1 Kings 4:32 tells us that he wrote over 1,000 songs, and this is the best of the bunch. This is the number one, in his opinion, of all the songs he wrote. When was it written? There is not a date in the book, nor do scholars agree on the exact time. Solomon wrote 3 books that found their way ultimately into the Bible. They are Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes, and Proverbs, that appear in the opposite order in the Bible. First we find Proverbs, and then Ecclesiastes, and then last his song. I am of the opinion that he wrote the song early in life, when his love was warm and innocent and beautiful and unscarred. He wrote Ecclesiastes in the midlife, when he was in the middle of the crises that we mentioned in our last study. And then I think he wrote Proverbs in his late years, when he was wise and had learned in a difficult way some of the lessons that life taught. So I suggest he wrote this song when he was young, when he was early on the throne of the land of Israel. Why has it been preserved? Probably to show us the human side of life in the days of a king like Solomon. It's easy to forget the humanity in great men and women. Song of Solomon will help you see that the man, like all of us, was very human. It is a song that extols human love. It exalts affection between married partners. And fourth, the question, how should it be interpreted? I suggest literally. I think you force upon it any other interpretation, even though, as I said earlier, it seems possible that the love of Christ and his relationship to the church would be seen here. That is not really the basic interpretation. I think it's the love of a man for a woman and her for him. Throughout the book, you will read of my darling, which is a reference to the woman, and my beloved, which is a reference to the man. And they dialogue back and forth in this love note, love song to one another. Before going any further, let me say this to you. The language of the book is exceedingly intimate, quite personal. It is the most intimate expressions found in all the Bible. So I say that on the front end of this study, so you will be comfortable, and I also will be comfortable, as we read over the shoulders of these two who were madly in love with each other. It'll just warm the romantic fire inside of you. And if it doesn't, there's something wrong with you. So let's take off and see what it has to say. To begin with, there is a title for the book right in the first verse, The Song of Songs, otherwise called the Canticles, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon. And then we move into the period of courtship. If you look on the back of your chart that you received this evening, you'll see the dialogue as it progresses through the book of the Song of Solomon. The bride speaks as the chief speaker to start with, chapter 1, verse 2 through chapter 3, verse 5. And then he becomes the chief speaker in chapter 3, verse 6 through chapter 5, verse 1. She comes back and answers him in chapter 5, verse 2 through the third verse of chapter 6. And he responds again as the husband in 6:4 through 8:4, and then both of them sort of sing together in antiphonal or either antiphonal or harmonious voice, the last part of the song that they do together. So it's quite a creative expression of love. Now the courtship days are set forth in a very creative manner. Verse 2 of chapter 1. May he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Well, you know right away you're in for some good stuff when you read that. Your oils have a pleasing fragrance. Your name is like purified oil. Therefore the maidens love you. Draw me after you and let us run together. The king has brought me into his chambers. And here's the bride, the wife-to-be, as she speaks of the king and his chamber, and he is to draw her into his chamber and to take her as his own beloved bride. Verse 7 continues, tell me, O you whom my soul loves, where do you pasture your flock? Where do you make it lie down at noon? Why should I be like one who veils herself beside the flocks of your companion? If you yourself do not know, most beautiful among women, go forth on the trail of the flock and pasture your young goats and by the tents of the shepherds. To me, my darling, now he answers. He responds to her in this note of love. To me, my darling, you were like my mare among the chariots of Pharaoh. It's a rather creative way to describe her. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with strings of beads. We will make for you the ornaments of gold with beads of silver. While the king was at his table, my perfume gave forth its fragrance. Verse 15, how beautiful you are, my darling, how beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves. How handsome you are, my beloved, and so pleasant. Indeed, our couch is luxuriant. I am the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valleys. Like a lily among the thorns, so is my darling among the maidens. And then she describes him and his love. Verse 4, he has brought me to his banquet hall, and his banner over me is love. Sustain me with raisin cakes. Refresh me with apples. I am lovesick. Wow. She is really caught up in this relationship with this man. He says, his left hand shall be under my head, and his right hand embrace me. Listen, my beloved, verse 8. Behold, he is coming, climbing on the mountains, leaping on the hills. He's like a gazelle or a young stag. Verse 10, my beloved responded and said, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. Winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers have appeared in the land. She muses about his love in verse 1 of chapter 3. On my bed, night after night, I sought him. I sought him, but I did not find him. And so she reaches out as she meditates on his absence, and she thinks, where could he be? So she asks the watchman of the city, and she pursues him. Verse 4, scarcely had I left them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held on to him and would not let him go until I had brought him to my mother's house and into the room of her who conceived me. They have courted, they have gone together in this growing, warm, beautiful, lovely relationship. And now the day of the wedding comes. Solomon writes, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the hinds of the field, that you will not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. She describes him coming in all of this wedding entourage. What is this coming up from the wilderness, like columns of smoke perfumed with myrrh and frankincense? Behold, it is the traveling couch of Solomon, 60 mighty men around it, of the mighty men of Israel. All of them are wielders of the sword, expert in war. Each man has his sword at his side, guarding against the terrors of the night. Solomon has made for himself a sedan chair from the timber of Lebanon. She describes it for us, and then he turns and speaks to her in loving terms as they are now married. How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats. I had a fellow tell me after the service was over at 5:30 that it doesn't work. He said he told his wife that very thing, and she drove home alone after the service. He uses expressions that are very familiar to that day, but not to ours. Look at what he says about her teeth, verse 2. Your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn ewes, which have come up from their washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them has lost her young. You've got all of your teeth. They're beautiful. Your lips are like a scarlet thread. Your mouth is lovely. Your temples are like a slice of pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with rows of stones on which are hung 1,000 shields. Wow, that guy is gifted, isn't he? Creative, huh? Verse 5. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away. That man knew how to do it, didn't he? Margaret Hardesty, in her book, Forever My Love, writes this. Oh, I lost my place. Oh, God. I can't believe it. I had the best quote, and I can't even find it. She says in her book how the man knows just the words to say at just the right time with just the expressions that are needed for her to understand the depth of his feelings for her. And he describes her in the most intimate fashion, and you turn in the very next chapter and she responds back to him in a similar manner. Verse 2, chapter 5. I was asleep, but my heart was awake. A voice, my beloved, was knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is drenched with dew, my locks with the damp of the night. I have taken off my dress. How can I put it on again? I have washed my feet. How can I dirty them again? My beloved extended his hand through the opening, and my feelings were aroused for him. It's an intimate expression of marital love in all of its beauty. And she says, I opened to my beloved, verse 6, and my beloved had turned away and had gone. My heart searched for him. He leaves, and then he comes back. And when he returns, she describes him. Verse 10, chapter 5. He is dazzling and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. His head is like gold, pure gold. His locks like clusters of dates and black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk and reposed in their setting. His cheeks are like a bed of balsam. His lips are lilies. His hands are rods of gold. His abdomen carved ivory. His legs are pillars of alabaster. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. His mouth is full of sweetness. He is wholly desirable. Christian friends, what poor lovers we are. The pace of our lives has so altered our steps that reading something like this, rather than melting us, humors us. Rather than warming us and motivating us to love like that, we take it as a strange kind of joke. And there are some who hear these words who long to have their mates respond anything similar to this. The best we can do is a candlelight meal, maybe twice a year. And even then, it takes 2 months planning, it seems. I want you to know that physical love is an art that cannot grow without being nurtured. And if left alone, will decay. And no amount of Bible study will replace it. No amount of church going or good intent or a busy schedule will take the place and meet the needs of physical love of a partner. In my travels, at times I have the privilege of going overseas and meeting with missionaries whom I have really learned to love. And to my amazement, it shouldn't be, but to my amazement, I have discovered they as well struggle just as deeply in this whole area of their intimate life. Some of which hang by a very thin, thin wire. And if you are excusing your lack of creative love because of an involvement in many, many spiritual things, you're choosing a lame excuse. Our Heavenly Father, who gave us bodies as well as souls and spirits, meant for the body and its love relationship to be nurtured in all of the security and beauty of marital love. If there is anyone who ought to have a virile romantic life, it is the Christian. And I mean that in ways other than just the sexual. I mean that in all of romance, all of the beauty of enjoying the body of a partner and enjoying the person and enjoying what they have to say and responding to their feelings, all of that interplay, that intimacy that makes a home, makes a marriage. That's what's here. And we're strangers to it. We need to be appreciated and noticed and loved and appealed to. That's the longing of hearts. In fact, there are some here single at this very moment who once were married because of the lack of that intimacy are no longer married. And it isn't just living with another person of the opposite sex. It is being intimately related. It is sharing in life and love and mutual interests. Donald Meredith has written a book called Becoming One, and in it he describes the progression of decay, which I thought was interesting. Four steps down. First, there is romanticism, then there is reality, and then there is resentment, and finally there is rebellion. What makes that happen? What must I do for that to happen? I'll tell you, nothing, and it will happen. In this fabulous, beautiful expression of love, I find how that lack occurs. I find it in a positive way here, and I want to share with you three or four things that often lack in a married life and a partnership, resulting in that decay. Please notice them. Remember what we saw in chapter 5, verse 2, as he says, shh, don't awaken her. Let her awaken alone. And then when she does, he adores her person. And she, in return, chapter 5, verses 10 through 16, she notices him. She says he's dazzling, he's ruddy, her desire is for him. His legs are like this, his abdomen is like that, his arms are like this, his face is like that, his hair is like this. She is enjoying his person. Brings me to the first lack, the lack of personal attention. Lack of personal attention. Why in the world is it that a married woman, attractive, married to an affluent, successful, capable man, will turn to another individual in an affair and build a relationship with that person who doesn't have half the looks that or money this one has, her partner, because that one gives her personal attention. She craves it. We all do. Let's face it. And this couple in this book observes, notices, they're wild about each other. She even says to him, verse 16 of chapter 5, he is wholly desirable. This is a good place to say some things about the difference between men and women in this matter of romance. I refer to Dr. James Dobson's fine book, What Wives Wish Their Husbands Knew About Women. He says this: an effort has been underway for the past few years to prove that men and women are identical except for the ability to bear children. Nothing could be further from the truth. Males and females differ biochemically, anatomically, and emotionally. In truth, they are unique in every cell of their bodies. For men carry a different chromosomal pattern than women. There is also considerable evidence to indicate that the hypothalamic region located just above the pituitary gland in the midbrain is wired very uniquely for each of the sexes. This provides women with a different psychological frame of reference than men. Further, female sexual desire tends to be somewhat cyclical, correlated with the menstrual calendar, whereas males are acyclical. These and other features account for the undeniable fact that masculine and feminine expressions of sexuality are far from identical. And then he describes two major differences, which are very helpful. First, men are primarily excited by visual stimulation, whereas women are primarily excited by the sense of touch. Second, and much more important, men are not very discriminating in regard to the person living within an exciting body. A man can walk down a street and be stimulated by a scantily clad female who shimmies past him, even though he knows nothing about her personality or values or mental capabilities. Not a woman. A woman is not like that. Women are much more discriminating in their sexual interests. They less commonly become excited by simply observing a good-looking male. A woman is stimulated by the romantic aura which surrounds her man, by his character, by his personality. She yields to the man who appeals to her emotionally as well as physically. Sex for men is a more physical thing, but for women it is a deeply emotional experience. You know what that says? It says that a woman has a great difficulty relating intimately to a person she doesn't respect. Thus, the tremendous need, men, in order to be wholly desirable to our wives, to maintain that respect, that challenge, that zest for living that she longs to find in you. We really earn the right to be loved. Now, men, I want to say something that maybe nobody else will tell you. No matter how spiritual you become, no matter how hungry you may be for the truth of God, that is never a substitute for noticing, loving, and appealing to your wife. Never. They ought to go hand in hand, but they don't, being given to extremes as we are. She needs to be noticed. She needs to be loved. She needs to be observed. She needs to be told what she means to you. Physical, personal attention. How many men in the ministry, of all careers where this should not be happening, how many men in the ministry tube out in their marriage because they fail to cultivate that love relationship with their partner? Very much involved in ministry, very little involved in the intimate attention given to their mates. A lack of personal attention. The second is a lack of leisure. Verses 1 through 9 of chapter 7. Turn there, if you will. Notice the time it will take to cultivate this creativity. How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter. The curves of your hips are like jewels, the work of the hands of an artist. Your navel is like a round goblet which never lacks mixed wine. Your belly a heap of wheat fenced about with lilies. Wow. Your twin breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like a tower of ivory. Your eyes like the pools in Hebshan, in Heshbon, by the gate of Bath-Rabin. Your nose is like the tower of Lebanon, faces toward Damascus. Your head crowns you like Carmel at mountain. Let me tell you, in order to be creative, you need leisure. You cannot be creative in a hurry. It takes time to cultivate a creative love relationship. It takes leisure. In the beauty and the charm and the elegance of this book, I see quietness and time to express, time to hear. I see time carved out for that growing relationship. It's easy to get into a rut, isn't it? There's a sign that appears on the Alaskan highway that reads, "Choose your rut carefully. You'll be in it for the next 200 miles. And I tell you, that aptly describes many a Christian home, many a Christian life. Set in a rut, set in a schedule, set in a routine, so that time for one another is aborted. Isn't that amazing? We have time for our work. We even have time to be punctual to our work. And when duty calls, we have time for overtime. Some have time for a second job. And when you have the money, you have time to pursue where you are going to buy that new car. You make time. You make time for that game, whether it's tennis or golf or racquetball or whatever. You take the time. It's a high priority. What kind of priority do you have or have you placed on your relationship with your mate? The days of old, in the days of Moses, they really had it down, even in the law. Look at Deuteronomy 24, verse 5. Deuteronomy 24, 5. Oh, for the good old days. Listen to this rule. The context of chapter 24 is when a man takes a wife and marries her, verse 1. Verse 5 says, "When a man takes a new wife, he shall not go out with the army." So he's free from military service. "Nor be charged with any duty. He shall be free at home 1 year and shall give happiness to his wife whom he has taken." Wow, isn't that great? An entire year of vacation. You see what I mean? The good old days. There it is. A sabbatical right off the bat. How about just an evening? How about just once a month? In 52 weeks, how about just a couple of weekends? Back to Song of Solomon, this brings us to the third lack of getaway escapes. We've talked about a lack of personal attention, a lack of leisure. Now, how about getting away together? Chapter 7, verse 10, she says, "I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me." So it begins with a desire for each other. And so she says to him, "Come, my beloved, let us go out into the country. Let us spend the night in the villages." So they see new places. They go to a spot that is away from their familiar habitat. And she says, "Let us rise early and go to the vineyards, and let us see whether the vine has budded and its blossoms have opened and whether the pomegranates have bloomed." That's beautiful. She's out in the country with her lover. And she says to him, let's notice some things that are going on that we don't normally take the time to notice. And so they look at the blooming flowers and they study the vines and they enjoy the countryside. the landscape. It's quiet and it's clear and it's intimate. They've gotten away for some time. And in it all, she says, there I will give you my love. There's no force. There's no sense of obligation. That's the most natural place in the world. Why do you think marriage encounter flourishes, or marriage enrichment seminars, or couples conferences? I can't remember the last couple conference that I spoke at that wasn't packed full. You know what I tell couples at these conferences? I tell them right off the bat on Friday night. Now, there are three things you cannot talk about. You cannot talk about work, you cannot talk about church, and you cannot talk about children. And they look at me as if to say, what in the world is there to talk about? If you take away the big three, what else do we have? Have you ever thought about your partner? Oh. And a whole world is opened up. And they, for the first time sometime in a year, are hearing what they have not heard during those 52 weeks past, because they've gotten away. Couples that I marry, I love to spend enough time with them for them to understand what that commitment is all about. So I tell them that more than likely they will be making a tape recording of their wedding. So when their anniversary rolls around, they are to take off at least for one night, preferably a weekend, near or at the time of their anniversary, and they are to listen to the tape of their wedding, hear their vows, and review their goals, and to see if they're still on target. It is amazing what that does, just to take a year's look every year at where you are and at where you're going. It's amazing. There's one more lack, and it is common in homes today, and that is what I will call a lack of security in one another's arms. A lack of security. Verse 4 of chapter 8. I want you to swear, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. Verse 6. Now that she's awakened, notice, put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. For love is as strong as death. The first major area of security needed in a relationship is commitment. My wife and I have gotten to the place where we now verbally declare our commitment to one another. Not that the other needs to hear it, though that is often true, but we need to say it. We verbalize our commitment. We declare our loyalty. We announce and affirm in the ears of the other the depth of our bond. I do that before trips and after trips. I do that in the humdrum of a week or in the quietness of a weekend. I declare it. There is something about sealing that relationship, taking time to confirm it. I don't know why it is, but there are some in the world today who seem to take it on as a delight to begin an affair with a married person. That is their desire. Twisted and strange though it may sound, that is one of their goals, to win over a married partner. And Christians are not immune to this. A commitment between partners is one of the finest magnets to keep a marriage strong. Set as a seal on your heart your love relationship. Second is the problem with jealousy. See verse 6. Jealousy is as severe as Sheol. Its flashes are flashes of fire. If anyone has had a battle with jealousy more than I in my earlier years in marriage, I've never met him. As severe a case of jealousy as I've ever seen a person struggle with was mine. for no reason. Perhaps it was part of an insecurity that I wrestled with at the time, but I'll never forget in the process of time how God slowly but surely took away that smothering, that jealous love, which really wasn't love at all. It was a bondage. And he replaced it with a quiet confidence, security in my wife's love. Continued questioning, continuing suspicion will destroy a love bond. That's why he says it's as cruel as the grave. And then toward the end of this love note, she sits in the gardens. The companions are listening for the voice. She says, "Let me hear it," verse 13. "Hurry, my beloved," she asks him, "to come back like a gazelle and to be with her." It's a desire to be together, to cultivate that companionship. Three things stand out as I close the book on the Song of Solomon that are of a practical nature. I pass them on to you. The first, reaching the deepest level of love takes commitment. Believe me, it isn't automatic. Until you are ready to say, "I am committed for the rest of my life to that individual," don't get married. When you are ready to say that and you say it and marriage occurs, whatever you do, don't stop saying it. To reach the deepest level calls for incredible commitment. I had a man share with me after the first service this evening that he had for the longest time been saving for an education, the education of his children. And he said that he and his wife had this educational fund that they set aside and they put monies into it regularly. And he said he finally realized that as their life was growing toward the twilight years and the children would soon be gone, that he needed to also have a fund called Getaway Fund. And so he would slip into that, the extra monies from time to time, and when it would reach a certain level, they'd use that alone to get away. And he said, it is remarkable what just a drive and an evening and at times even a night spent away from children, cares, other things would do to refreshen that commitment. Take time. Take time. If it is a question between whether you will come to another service at a church or take time, and that time is needed in the home in a greater way, take time that day. It is worth it. I confess to you, one of the frustrations of being involved in ministry every weekend is the lack of weekend time, personally, in my own life. One of the reasons that we enjoy on occasion couples conferences is for our own nurturing and our own cultivation of our own marriage. We face the same battles every married couple I've ever met faces. Reaching that level takes commitment. Second, understanding the different expressions of love takes patience. You will have one kind of expression of love that will be very important to you, but your partner will have another kind. It takes patience to see both kinds. I don't know what it is about candles. I can't explain it. It's amazing. They're like magic. You know? Flashlights are not as good. That doesn't work. You flick that on and it takes it all away. But there's something about a candle that'll do it. And if it takes a candle, use candles. Great. It's remarkable what a simple, beautiful piece of music will do to fill an evening with the tube off. And it takes patience and understanding to give so that that can be nurtured. If you want to be proud of something new as a child of God, be proud of your romance. Because if you have it, you're unique as a Christian couple. It takes patience takes commitment. Third, becoming the best kind of lover takes time. It takes time. A number of years ago, I had the privilege of marrying a choice couple. The kind that you would say, had you been a bug on the wall in the counseling chamber and had been able to listen to our conversation, the kind you would say, ah, that is a model. Would that all of them had everything going for them that this couple does. The man was a graduate of a medical school, had come out very near the top of his class, very bright, very well-traveled, very keen and sensitive. He had to finish his military commitment, so they had plans, he and his registered nurse wife, bride-to-be. They were to leave after marriage and to begin their honeymoon, their new life together, as he finished his residency in a military context. So it meant they would leave the city where we lived at the time, and I would lose touch with them, something I don't like to do with couples that I marry. I like to at least stay within physical and visible touch with them just to help if there's the need. And so we promised to correspond. It was a lovely wedding, memorable evening, fine family, all of them Christians, as I recall, even to the grandparents that were there. And they had everything going for them. She looked lovely. It was a beautiful night. They called me the next morning as they left, and we said goodbye on the phone, and their lives together began. After a couple of letters, however, we lost touch with each other. They moved a second time. I lost their address, or at least I never got it because they stopped writing. Time passed. As we reached the end of about a three-year period of time, I got a call one night. As I recall, it was a Friday, Thursday or Friday evening, and I heard her voice. She said, "Could I come talk to you?" The next day she came, and we sat down, and I looked into the face of a woman who in 3 years had aged 15, 18, 20 years. She looked like she was in her late middle age years, even though she was 23, 24 years old. She said, I can't believe what's happened. We're now divorced. She said, when we left, the pace began, the hurry led into worry and led into another job, and I got into drugs and he got into drugs. They were easy come from our profession, and then we mixed it with alcohol, and before we knew it, I was into an affair with a fellow across the hall, and he was involved in a whole syndrome of this miserable life. And our lives separated. She said, well, I worked at night, he worked in the day. I slept in the day, he slept at night. And when our schedules changed, they just flip-flopped and vice versa. And she said, as a result, without even realizing it, we lived in two different worlds. She said, I wish someone would have come and taken me by the shoulder and shaken me hard and said to me, wake up. You're losing everything. You have forgotten just the basics of what marriage is about. But she said no one was there, and it seemed like it happened overnight. Slowly but surely, the adversary wins the victory, and another marriage crumbles. Strange thing, she said, almost every weekend, believe it or not, we were in church. Christians involved in a church, slowly separating, decaying in their relationship. Let's pause and commit our lives to the Savior. Let's bow this evening. I realize as I speak, I look into the faces of many who are single. I understand that some of this is not applicable to you. Others of you are directly involved in what has been said. My desire for those of you who are married is that you see the need for time. You forfeit that need, your marriage will grow cold. I promise you. I warn you. For you thinking about marriage, I have tried to arouse you tonight to realize that it is the deepest of any human relationship. Until you're ready for that kind of commitment, don't step into it. Lord God, I pray that as a result of what we have heard from this fine yet intimate book, might do a very beautiful work in the life of at least one, perhaps two or three couples here who needed to hear these things. We need to know what it means to take time for basic, high priority commitments. We need to know how to say no to things that are not that significant. We need help and discipline in turning off the television and turning away from an every night involvement in things. We need to know how to listen, how to be sensitive. We need to have creative ways of expressing our feelings and patience in hearing our friend and partner express theirs. Lord, you who made us and you who understands us better than anyone else, you are the one that is able to give us what we need. Help us. Direct our thoughts along your lines of thinking, Father, as we grow in becoming one, even as Christ is one with us. We pray it in his name and for his sake. Amen.
The preceding message, Song of Solomon, Poem of Faithful Love, was copyrighted in 1979, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2011 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide.